The following interview was conducted with Sylvia as part of Wollongong City Council Library's Illawarra Stories Oral History Project. It took place at her home on the 9th of August 2018. So Sylvia, you grew up in this area?
Yes, I was born at Haberfield to a mother who came from Fairy Meadow, a father who came from Tarawana. And during the Depression, they had two children, my older brother and I, and came back here to live because my great-grandma owned a lot of houses. She owned all of Fairy Meadow east of the Princess Highway. And as her children... Her name was Frost. There's a lot of history on her husband and sons in the mine disaster. They got gold medals, silver medals, bronze medals, yeah. But I only knew my great-grandma, and she lived till nearly 100, so I knew her well. And so she lived in Elliot's Road. So every house along there belonged to one of my relatives. And around the corner in Daisy Street, she built that little church. Her plaque is still on it. So we came down here. Dad got a job in the steelworks, but his father wasn't well, so we left the house in Wollongong, the street up over the railway bridge there, that one that goes down, to go and live with my grandfather in Tarawana. He was full of shrapnel from the First World War, and I was going to be a nurse, and I was very disappointed that he would not let me go in on Saturdays. My brother used to go in with a little enamel bowl and tweezers to pull out the shrapnel that had come to the top, and I always thought it must have been down in his private area that he wouldn't let me do it. But my brother has now told me, no, it was actually in his back where he couldn't reach. Yeah, but he still wasn't having a little girl come do it. Yes, so I grew up in Tarawana. It was two streets. There was just cow paddocks between Tarawana Road, and that ran right around, to the Princess Highway. And then down at the western end was the property for the man that's got his name on that street now. On the part that came around to the Princess Highway at Corrimal, where they built Streets Factory later, so they had the actual dairy there. So I used to have to walk with a little billy can to get the milk. When I was four, I was too early young to go to school, but my mother gave me a piece of paper with my name and address on it to take up to the school to start school. I don't know when they realised I was too young, but I had to repeat kindergarten. They called that transition. I really love school. The local people used to give me all their old books. I had to win the Sunday school prize and win the school prize every year to get a book. I had an amazing time growing up. My mother couldn't stand me, so I knew I had to be up. She used to make you get up at 5 o'clock when she did. And I'd take off up into the mountains, and in the summer I would walk down. I didn't learn to swim until I was five, so by then I'd had a couple of near drownings. Oh. And I always knew when I was actually, and one of them was down at the Wollongong Baths, because when you were five you could go and learn to swim. We'd had to walk from Tarawana, so we'd had breakfast before we left, and we took our lunch with us. We were hungry when we got there. We ate our lunch and went in the pool before anybody's come. So I got a the only time I've ever gotten a sting in your leg, and I was drowning. So the boy and girl that I went with, they had just come from the country, so they couldn't swim. But she was trying to hold me up, and the little boy, he must have been a year younger than me, and he ran screaming, and a fisherman came and dived in. And I know I was drowning because every time I was drowning and somebody threw me out, you go over the edge and all the water pours out of you. Yeah. So in those days, a lot of children died. They died of things like one kid in my class died of a rat bite. Two of them we made a cubby house over the weekend. They wagged school to go to it, but there's no way I would have wagged school. So when we come out, we found they'd cooked something in there and it burnt down and burnt the two kids. There was always something going on. And a little girl from my class died of diabetes. And we always said, because her mother used to make the hard
toffees.
Yeah. All through school, that was just absolutely amazing. I'd put in to go to domestic science because I was going to be a nurse, and they sent a couple of men down from Sydney to see my parents. So then they got me in. They wanted to know why I wouldn't go to Wollongong High School, because I wanted to be a nurse, and the domestic science had a course. And oh no, but they've got all the things that you need at Wollongong. And I said, oh, but they got languages. I don't want Latin. I don't want to do that. No, 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 no. So when I get there, what have they done? Put me in the two language thing. Mm-hmm. So I had a wonderful time there for 3 years. And then my mother wouldn't let me go on if I was going to waste it on nursing, because nursing wasn't looked on as that was for... the brainless.
I thought nursing was always a good occupation, yeah.
For people that couldn't do anything else, but if you could be a teacher, yeah, so I didn't want to be a teacher. And as it turned out later, when I did health science education, I thought I was right. I could never have been a teacher of classes like that, but I loved what I was teaching. I had to leave school, but I had to have the money for my mother. Was always in debt. My poor father was always doing doublers to try to pay some bill that they're going to take it to court for. So I knew I had to buy my uniform. So I went down to the steelworks and asked for a job and were amazed that they took me straight on. So they put me into this little room where I had to do the filing. There were two girls in there. It was about, we were all skinny in those days, so two could pass one another. But anyway, their system was all wrong, so I got two to fix it, but they couldn't understand what I was doing. So I had to be the one that answered the door to everybody to get their papers. And here's all these men in suits and, oh dear, and they're questioning me about this, and I thought I was going to get the sack. I'd only been there a week. And they went off, nothing was said about it, but one came back and he said, when you're finished here, could you come and do mine? So they redid all the things, and then the manager took me out of there. They wanted me to go to Sydney to do a course. No, because I'm going nursing. So they had me for 2 years, so it was amazing the things that I was doing for them. And I hadn't been there 2 years when I left to go nursing.
So about what year was this, roughly?
Okay, so that was 1953, 1954. And 1955, I went nursing to St George.
So you mentioned something earlier about a Japanese boat going past.
Okay, well, living with my grandfather in Tarawana, a man was supposed to, when the Japanese came, a man was supposed to take us up to the mine at Corrimal. Anyway, this boat going along, they didn't know what it was, but this man had disappeared. So my mother put us to sleep underneath her double bed, my brother and I on our mattresses. I woke up in the night. I spent a life having premonitions. So I got up and I went out, and there was my mother on the back step with an axe across. Well, you could see it was moonlight night, and you could see right across the paddocks. She lived till 98, so a few years back, she heard me telling somebody Mum was going to take on the Japanese army with an axe. And she came around and she said, "Oh, you silly idiot, as if I would have done that. I was going to kill you kids. I wasn't going to let them have you." And Mum used to kill the chook every Christmas. Yeah. So...
So she'd seen it going past.
No, that was announced to us. Oh. I don't know where I heard that, but we ran down to see. There was an unidentified boat going, and it was that night. So I've never followed up on this to see if that was the boat that brought the submarines in. Yes, but of course the next day, you know, it was obviously very worrying for everybody. And every town had a cinema, picture show. So it was all, every Saturday afternoon we went and all these things were on. So it was very easy to follow the war. And of course, we had a cenotaph outside the Corrimal Public School there. So every Monday we all lined up while I announced who'd been killed. And one day it was my best friend's brother. I bit right through the inside of my mouth trying not to laugh. And it took me years to realise that when I'm really upset, and you couldn't show emotions in those days, I was biting inside my mouth to stop from laughing. It was, once I started to learn all about, well, mental health as they call it now, that
made sense.
That all made sense, yeah.
So have you any other wartime memories? How was that for you as your family?
Well, I never saw my dad because he was put in charge of all the traffic at the steelworks. But my mother, horrible lady, she said to me, "Oh, he got a white feather because he hasn't gone to war, you see." But he wasn't allowed to go. He slept down there. I never saw him through the war. He had a crib, he used to call it, that he slept in. Yeah, when he had to go to sleep, he'd go and sleep. So he spent the war there. He was the supervisor of traffic. So that was all the train trucks in and all the rest of it. He'd had nothing to do with that, which I thought was interesting when I found out what my great-grandfather was the manager of Kembla Mine. But when I tried to find anything on that, I couldn't. But your Wollongong Library found me books. I couldn't work out why the two brothers got a gold and a silver. But then I read in one of those books that my great-great-great-great had refused the gold. He was the first to lead the men in on the rescue mission. But he realised they had open flames. They had to get out of there and get the non-flammable ones. He realised that he would do better organising it from up the top because his ankles were very swollen. So obviously his kidneys had gone on. He died 2 years later. So he wouldn't accept, because his sons had done more, so he wouldn't accept a gold, but he accepted a bronze. So that's back before the war. So the war years, I've got a blot on my conscience there. This little girl from kindy at school, she came out for me to take her the fruit out of the orchard, but she had to come to Sunday school with me first, and then down we went. And this, the creek at Taroji, on the western, southern side, that was an orchard, Italians. He'd been put into a camp because we were fighting the Italians. She was left to look after this orchard. So we're putting the apples down our shirts, and she come out with the broom. So we took off up the side. She couldn't get up there and follow us. And when I told my father, and we pulled out the apples, they were quinces, which needed cooking, but they're full of grubs. And he says, "Serves you right."
Wow. So your dad did know what mischief you'd been up to.
I guess I was always up to mischief because I absolutely ran wild and free by myself in the bush. And as I said, in the summer I walked, but coming back in the afternoons with that sun in your face, that was very hard.
So you're 17 now.
Okay.
Oh, you've done 2 years at the steelworks.
Got the money for my uniform. So up I go to St. George. I'd always been travelling. Mum would pay for anything to get rid of me. So I went on girl guide camps, school camps, all that sort of stuff. So off I went to St. George, the good old steam train that used to take a few hours, that stopped at every station. On the way back, I'd usually fall asleep, especially after night duty. And I'd wake up in time to get off at Fairy Meadow, and my uncle used to put me... He used to put me in a taxi and send me. So I didn't worry about falling asleep. Okay, so I started at 17. Now, they talk about the first terrorist act here. We had Dr. Brucci and his sister were blown up and brought into St. George. That had to be...
Blown up?
Yes. Never heard of... this ever again, can't find anything on it. Okay, so Dr. Brucci came into my ward. In those days, you didn't have, you had the, what's called, emergency, the casualty. But if they were bad, they came straight for the ward for you to prep them and send them up to theatre. Oh, what a mess. And the ambulance men had to lift him off onto the bed. And he gave me, in those days you had Macintoshes, and it was full of blood. And he carried it for me out to the slunges. We used to call these big things where we used to have to wash everything up. And he dumped it in the sink, and he took off, and I turned on the hot water tap. I congealed it all. So there's me trying to scrape this all off. The sister went to the female ward on the other side where my friend, she's only just died, so we started there at 17 and, we've got that life history. She had the lady. But what they did, they ran them up to theatre on the bed that they were on. We didn't have ones that you used to have to lift them up and put a block underneath. So off, they were already racing with her. It had a lift because it was only two stories. So they had a lift to take her first, and we had to wait and then get him up. But we heard first that she died. I don't think he actually came back to the ward. I wasn't there for that part. I'd gone off duty. But anyway, he died too.
And you didn't hear how or the accident
Not
happened?
A word. So I surmised, because I'd always been interested in this, that they're probably German Nazis and somebody's recognised them and blown them up, because two Nazi ships sailed to Fremantle and discharged them all. Well, they've come across... through as far as Sydney. So it was mainly Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney. But over the years, I met people that were obviously Germans from that era. They won't talk to you, and the whole thing would fall into place and you'd know these people. So I wasn't surprised when the Israelis found one man down in Adelaide. Yeah.
Goodness.
Yeah. Okay. I did the 4 years there. Now,
and you travelled all the time on.
Oh well, on only train. Once a year. Yeah. Oh yeah, up and down
up
here.
And down
but well, not that often because I was always somewhere else, and I'd get the call that they needed me back there for some member of the family. So anyway, when I started nursing, I was in seventh heaven. It was me right from the start, and I could write. People used to say you should write a book on this. I say, well, every year would need a But one of the things that happened, I was sent to the chest ward, and just as they brought out the drugs for TB, and it emptied out, because I always remember back to that, to know whatever isn't working that you think can never work, something, I always say God interferes and fixes it somehow, but these drugs, and I can remember looking at them, how did they get these big, huge things down the gullet? Yeah. But anyway, it emptied out the place, and by then we'd run out of space for all the TB people. My auntie had died. She lived at Blamby. She died. A lot of the pregnant women died. They'd have the baby and then they die. So I looked at what we had left, and all we had left was 5 cancer of the lungs. And they were all very heavy smokers. In those days, you smoked in your bed. And I said, I think that smoking is causing the cancer. Oh, they poo-pooed me. I was the only person that didn't smoke. Couldn't afford to.
Well, a lot of people smoked, didn't they?
No, everybody. Mm. I had no relative, friend or colleague. So the doctors used to be horrible to nurses in those days, and they were particularly horrible to me. We've come a long way since then.
The TB. Did you say you had, there was a polio outbreak?
No, that was back at Wollongong.
Oh, okay.
So what else? Oh, well, I did special typhoid, and until they did the autopsy, they didn't know. I did get, I specialed golden staph on night duty, and then when I went back onto day duty, my shoe had rubbed. So here was I with the golden staph, and they couldn't cure it. They had something that they got out from America and couldn't cure it, and I thought, oh, this is the end of my nursing. And then I was in trouble because my friends had put me in a wheelchair in the night and take me down to wash my hair. Because the head of the hospital dealt with the nurses in those days. He said, well, what am I going to do with you, sort of thing? And I said, I wish you'd let me do what we always did for germs. You went into the sea... and the sun. So they couldn't let me go down to the sea, so they stopped, because you couldn't let water go near this, salt water to clean it, and wheel me out into the sun. And it was better in no time.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, I was always, you know, doing things. Even my first day in children's ward, and I took the temperatures used to be taken in their rectum, and it had a bit of blood on there. Oh, I've gone through it. I've gone through it. Well, they'll have to take her to theatre. I've got to confess this, but this is the end of my nursing. So there was the specialist with our head sister. So I went up and I confessed, and the whole place just went crazy because he had a lot of doctors with him. Oh, he thanked me for my powers of observation. He really went on about it. So this dreadful sister, she was absolutely horrible. And so after that, I spent most of my time in children's ward. It was an intersusception where the bowels telescoped. took it up to theatre and had it right in 5 minutes.
That was a good thing.
Yeah.
So the children's wards in those days, because parents weren't allowed in, and what was that?
Parents weren't allowed into Wollongong after what I'd been used to at St George. Then to come to Wollongong and be put in the children's ward, I couldn't believe it. I think a couple of days a week for an hour or something. So what I used to do, the sister on there was also the old school horrors, and I used to push the beds out onto the balcony, and the mothers are all on the other side. So the general manager of that, oh, he was a wonderful doctor, and he come to me about it, because she's obviously put in a complaint, And I said to him, you know, this isn't good enough. The mothers have to, the child has to see the mother. And anyway, so they increased all the visiting hours. So, of course, she wasn't very happy with me. But there were so many things that happened there. There was a little boy. The blood was coming out as fast as they were putting it in. Of course, you were on the ward in those days. You didn't. So he's in the corner of the ward, but for all the other poor kids around him. And we used to get a day and a half off. I went off to Newcastle and I read it must have been a weekend because I read the paper the next day, 11 bottles, and I thought, oh, that poor mother seeing this as the headlines. So I came back and I went to do my round and the bed is empty and made up. So naturally I took it for granted. Oh, well, I haven't put anybody back into his bed yet. And as we're going around, I'm getting and I said, but he died. And she said, he's in the waiting room waiting for his mother. Because I said to this doctor, this does not make sense to me. You're saying it's because he swallowed marbles. Marbles don't break. You'd wait for them to pass in the bowel action. Because I'd spent so much time in children's ward. So therefore, they haven't broken, so something else is causing this. So they're prepping him for theatre when I left. Same thing, an intussusception. I thought, I don't believe that. After I hadn't guessed that. I just knew that they were on the wrong track thinking they'd broken. Then there was another little boy, and it was his knee. And I said to this doctor, I was only in there a couple of months, and I said to this doctor, I feel there's something very wrong there. I don't suppose you'd open up and have a look. Well, they did, but it was too late. But at least they were able to fix it so he didn't end up losing his leg. So it must have been because I was in so good with him, or maybe it was just to get me out of children's ward with this sister. There was one little girl, and she'd written it up big. I had actually looked at her chest myself because to this day I say doctors never look at anybody's naked body. They've never seen a naked body. But I always threw everything back off them, wrote my report, handed over to her, went off duty. They found she had a rash that was not there because I'd seen it. But she's written it up big as though I had been, you know, oh, geez. So anyway, they had the outbreak of polio, and I wasn't asked about this. I was just told they were sending me and three doctors down to Fairfield Infectious Diseases. Oh, I was in seventh heaven. She was the nurse who survived the Japanese massacre of our Australian nurses. They'd already survived the bombing of their ship, but because they were Australian nurses, they could all swim. So they got to land. The Japanese rounded them up, took them around the headland and machine gunned them. So she had three bullets in her. And she pretended she was dead in the water. So they all left, and when it was getting dark, she came out and she was found by two Australian soldiers who'd escaped the camp. So they knew if she was, it didn't matter if they were found and had their heads cut off, but they would have to kill her because she could tell the tale. So they smuggled her back into the camp, and she was in the hospital in the camp. And when she was better, then she stayed nursing in the camp for the rest of the thing.
So when you weren't nursing, what was the social life like at the time?
Well, every night that I wasn't working at St George, I went dancing because every town had a dance on a different night. I'd at least get the barn dance. They'd come in from the hotel. They got thrown out at 10 o'clock. And that was when they'd put on the barn dance because all the men could dance with the women. So the last time I ever went was the day that there was only a couple of us left, and fellas would come in and look at the two of us and walk out, and in the end she got up and loved dancing.
So, sorry, back to the polio thing and you going, being sent to Fairfield.
Right. So when I, the two male doctors were horrible. The lady, now you'd know her, Pat Mowbray and Dr. James. The doctors used to sneak me up the back stairs to teach, for me to teach them all the children's things. Both of them married nurses later, but my name was James. So Dr. James picked me up one day, and we both had wedding presents. He was going to a wedding and so was I, so he took me up. So that got around that we were actually married. But he was wonderful. Yes. The polio outbreak, I remembered the polio outbreak at Tarawana that my mother used to give us kerosene on sugar. Now, that kerosene really wrecks your lungs, so lucky to have survived that. But I knew so many that did die or that were left very, very bad. We hadn't really gone very far down Fairfield infectious diseases in Melbourne. They just could get them out because they had a machine that they could put on them and take them out. But their lives were spent there in an iron lung. So I had two iron lungs at the hospital, and one of them was in the hospital and one was down in the... When I left to go down there, it was like a nursing home where you didn't have anywhere to send them to, but you also had kids, mainly Aboriginal kids, with whooping cough and things like that. They weren't immunised. And so when I got back, they'd emptied out of this place and sent them to nursing homes, but they still had one little Aboriginal boy.
So you said there was polio at Tarawana?
When I was young, yeah. So we're over that. So here I was in the children's ward there. They sent me and three doctors down. The two male doctors didn't think I should be there. But as soon as we hit the place, I am writing. And one of them grabbed it out of my hand and he's going through it. And you could see, oh, he handed it back. Polio is nursing. It's not. There's nothing for a doctor to do. So I get back here. The first day on, I did my thing with children. Bulbar polio. Little Debbie, 5 years old. Oh, my God. So I rang up Pat and told her, and she said she was with the pediatrician, they'd call in because he's got to go up to Children's Hospital. He called in and said it wasn't. Oh, so I wouldn't leave the child. Mines had given me a machine to get them breathing, a personal machine. No instructions. I didn't know how to work it, but I put it there next to her. The nurses come and brought me my breakfast, and next thing, Pat's back. And she never used to say much, but she's just, and she said, I'm just going to go and talk to the two doctors who'd come down there with us. They were both specialists too. So she came back with them, and what they decided, no mobiles in this, they couldn't get him until he got to Children's Hospital. They left a message up there. But she deteriorated so quickly. So we called an ambulance and I thought, oh, my God, I've never done a cut down in my life. And that's all for me. And the head of theatres turned up. She was another old battle axe. But she'd made the first mistake when I was in children's ward. And I hadn't told anybody. I just sneaked up the back stairs and found her and told her what had happened. So she fixed all that up. But I never wrote it up, never told anybody. So I think a bit of it is that baby for her to have her moment of glory too. But she said to me, would you like me to do... Oh, yes, please. So she did that and we got that little girl off, but she died. Yeah. But this kept happening. one of the sisters, I went to live out, which nobody had ever done before.
So you weren't in the nursing quarters?
I was at first, but I had friends who dumped, everybody else had done teaching, and they had a house in Kembla Street, and would I come and live? It was a closed-in veranda, and I could come and go without disturbing. And, okay, so I did that. This sister said to me, all excited. She was always excited every time she thought I'd done something wrong, and then it turned out I'd done something right. So this was another time, and I thought, look, they're not going to sack me over this. At least I wasn't worried about that. She said they're having a big meeting about you. They're all up there in the big boardroom. Oh, so I was leaving St. George, so I didn't have time to have the full thing, and I thought, I'll get it down there. Tasmania didn't have it until I was coming back, because I'd gone down to Tasmania to do the midwifery at a hospital with no doctors, because I wanted to be a missionary nurse in Africa. And then you went to London to do their midwifery because you did it out in the home. So it was like a finishing school for all this. Yet, while I was down there, they brought it in before I came back, and I thought, well, I'll get it when I come back.
She made three.
So I came back, they didn't have any. Somebody had pulled a thrill because it was all around, the polio was all around the lake. They got, when they finally got some, they gave it up there. I made sure all my staff were vaccinated, but I didn't tell anybody I wasn't.
So it was prevalent around the lake area, polio.
Yeah, so one boy that came in, I'd known him at Wollongong High. He died. One lady who came in, she'd had all her children done, but she hadn't been done herself, and she died. But I was the one that was diagnosing, and nurses weren't allowed to diagnose. I knew the doctor, I think it might have been Dr. James, up in casualty, sent this meningitis to me, and so I was game enough. I rang him up and I said, you don't think this could be bulbar polio, do you? Oh, my God, slam with the phone, and I could hear his feet running down. So it was after that, I think, that I'd done this too many times. So they couldn't have a nurse diagnosing, so they brought out a little machine that you put in so that you could measure their breathing. And I thought, what's up with them all? You don't need a bloody machine. You just ask them a question. And I asked little Debbie a question, and she said, Sister, if I'm a good girl, can I have a lolly after? And to save my soul, I could not lie. And I lied and said yes. I knew she'd never have a lolly in her mouth again.
Oh, dear. So after your stint with the polio, then where did you head?
Oh, I went to Newcastle. After my midwifery, I was going to London.
So midwifery was quite different in those days?
Well, especially in a hospital without doctors. We called them in when we needed them. And it was very different to back in Sydney. They were fighting to get 20 patients because the doctors were fighting for their own, the student doctors. Whereas we had to have 100 for the hospital. But after that, I didn't even bother to keep count. But if you could, we used to give them to one nurse. I don't even know. I must ask him, did he actually have it done?
So your midwifery training was, you said you went to London.
No, I couldn't go to London because my mother said my grandmother was dying. I had to come and look after her. So the first thing, and the doctor had gone away and said she wouldn't be there when he got back in 2 weeks. So I assessed her. No, she's got dementia, very early onset dementia. So she would have been about 52 because she died at 62. So she had it more than 10 years, so 50-ish. So understand a doc, a GP making a mistake like that. No, it was my mother. She was going into hospital. She wanted me to look after her. So I missed the last boat out. After that, you had to fly over. Yeah. So I thought, well, I can't. I said, well, who's going to pay to keep me? No way I was getting any money. I just had to. I'd get me free board. And I thought, well, this isn't going to work. So that was when I got the job at Wollongong Hospital and lived in. So that took care of all that. I could still pop back to Nana every day and all the rest of it.
How was life living in? Was that a very strict routine?
It was very set. I'm a young person coming in new, and the ones who were closest in age to me were all very set in their ways. I'd go to church with anybody wherever they were going because every church I went to, it just didn't work for me. So that was a given. The morning afternoon teas and suppers were a given, and I had never in my life had time for any of that. It was just the whole, and no music, no nothing, and
curfews?
Oh, yeah. Can't remember what it was then. But we had a curfew at St. George, and we came back with all the footballers and to get our swimming costumes on, and the Kingsgrove Slasher had been around, and we couldn't get back out to tell them. Because she used to climb through the nurse in the front. You climb through her window. Yeah.
And so there was signing in, signing out, and, you know, they weekend passes or...
Yeah, I think 10 o'clock was the latest you could be out. Yeah. But anyway.
You're midwifery. You couldn't... You missed the last boat.
Yes. So that was when I got the job there. But... on the train up and back to my friends in Sydney, met an Italian who was down visiting his cousin, and he met me and arranged to meet me when we came back. And I was up at the hospital and I was living in. And so I started to go out with him, but working every weekend with him in Newcastle, he saw more of my friends I was living with than me. So I went up because I couldn't get a job in midwifery here. So I went up and got a job in midwifery up there. Oh, my God. I took one more little dead baby and I thought, because in those days they didn't do anything with them, and it was just a small room with shelves, all these little bundles, because they weren't collected in any way. They just incinerated them after a while. And I just looked at that and I thought, I can't do this. I can't stand by. One mother nearly throttled me because she'd gotten hold of my gown and I couldn't get to the baby. I'm fighting the mother. I'd never seen such frightened mothers because... all of ours come to us beforehand. We did exercise, breathing and exercises for pregnant women. My daughter carted me off with her first baby. I said, I was teaching this back in the 50s. But it makes a huge difference to having a baby.
So how did you meet your husband?
Okay, well, my Italian... I'd learned Italian by then too, yeah. I'd learned French at school. So when he told his mother that he was going to marry me, he never heard from her again. So his sister wrote to, because in those days it used to take months to get, just get a letter over, let alone back. So she wrote to her mother, and her mother said he was going out of his mind, because I said, well, go and see if she'll come back here, because it was easy to come and live in Australia in those days. But she wouldn't, But he couldn't leave her there by herself. So after a while, the letters petered out. I thought, that's it. So then I met my husband. He was living in a boarding house that two of my friends were living in. They'd gone to live out from the nursing home too. And he was just lovely. I came back all excited one day, and nobody was back there yet. He was there. And I was excited because I'd just gotten a job as a matron of an orphanage. Why would you wonder? I said, all I ever wanted to do was get married and have children. I'm the only one that didn't, because everybody married young except our nurses, because they had to wait till they were 21 to finish nursing. But by the time I was 22, but things that I could do, I did the third certificate, the triple, because you had to leave nursing. You couldn't do things like that. And to this day, I've never met another triple certificate nurse. So I had that up my sleeve as well. But this was a Catholic orphanage. They were the only ones that still had orphans because they wouldn't let their babies go to anybody but a Catholic home. The pill had come in, and so all the orphanages had closed up, but the Catholic girls weren't taking the pill. But the only orphanages were this Catholic one. But it didn't make any difference. They were so thrilled to have me because they wanted to set up a Tresillian. And I was already doing that. I was already working at the Tresillian. When I finished doing it at Petersham, by then I realised that, because I went and did that while Mario was away. So by the time I'd done that, the matron of the North Shore one asked me, would I like to come and work with them to get some experience, because I was back to going over to Africa, except it was too unsafe for me. So this would work out nice. I would have my children. I'd bought a block of land on the lake. It hadn't been built on yet. So I still look at when it comes around like that, and that was where my home was going to be. And that was when my husband said to me, why? I said, well, why don't you get married? And I said, well, nobody's ever asked me. So he said, oh, well, he'd ask me then. His doctor told him to get married. He was 12 years older than me. He was lonely. He'd come out with a friend, and the friend's brother and his own brother had come back from Canada. But the four of them had married and moved away. So I think he was lonely. But anyway, so I married him.
And the orphanage?
Well, I couldn't go and do that, obviously. But we had a lovely Catholic girl doing her training with us. So I went to see them and told them about her. And, oh, yeah. So as soon as they were prepared to wait for her to finish her training, and then she went over there. But it didn't take long before. Are you Catholic?
No.
All the Catholic girls started to take the pill. I went up to my friends overnight, and there on top of the fridge was the pill.
So did you build your house down on the lake?
No. I got my money back. And I bought, because he worked at Qantas, so, you know, couldn't ask him to move. So I sold that and bought on the Georges River, overlooking the Georges River. And I built on there. Mm-hmm.
And so you lived up there for how long?
Oh, 45 years.
And so when did you come back here?
So I've been here, say, nearly seven, and I was there nearly seven, so about 14 years ago.
So what was your wedding like?
Oh, my uncle said it was the worst wedding he'd ever been to. I had it up in Piccadilly for the Church of England further up. What do you call that one?
St. Mark's.
I was doing this for everybody that had to come by train. We had it there to start. Oh, everything went wrong. It was just incredible because I had to arrange the whole thing. I was living in at the Tresillion on the North Shore. I had a little Volkswagen by then, so I could come and go easily. But they'd put a VIP's wedding on at St Mark's. They'd fitted her in before me, in between two of us. So she was an hour or so late. My mother sat in the front of the church for her wedding. I got tired of them going round and round, and I said, look, just if my husband sees me, too bad. But he'd already been seated in somewhere waiting anyway, so he couldn't have seen me. So eventually we got married, but then we were running so late to get to the Piccadilly. So they did a very rushed affair because they had something on for that evening. And to make it worse, my husband's sister was in Canada. So she rang, and she hadn't talked to either of her brothers for so long. I couldn't get them off the phone. I can remember when I had to get out of my dress. I couldn't, my bridesmaid was my sister, and I couldn't find her. I never did find her. I had my lipstick in my dad's pocket, I think, and forget where he'd gone to. But all I wanted to do was walk away from my own wedding.
That's sad. Did you get to go on a honeymoon?
Right. Works for Qantas. I've been travelling the world. Naturally, I think we're going somewhere. And all I could talk him into was Norfolk Island, because that was, I realised afterwards, the closest place to get to. He'd never been on a plane. He'd come out on the boat. He had a world trip. You got it every 10 years.
So what did he do for Qantas?
He was an engineer, ground engineer. They made him the foreman when he got married. He fell apart with that. So he'd become like a gopher, I think. But
so he hadn't travelled, really. Didn't like it.
Well, he was in Palestine for the war. But, no, he hadn't travelled anywhere. He'd stayed at home with his father. The rest of them had all left home when the mother had died. Yeah, so when his father died, he and his friends decided to 10-pound poms, you know. They were Scottish, but they all came out as 10-pound poms.